the bill, and she's working on it, Doug's working on it, so.
Okay.
Ready to go over there? Good morning, this is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we are here on Thursday, the, what, 22nd or something?
Or something.
And everybody's having fun. We're going to start off with the presentation from HEC, so come on down. And this presentation is on OLS.
It might still be on the Tuesday agenda.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And Juan can introduce himself.
Good morning, Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez, Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion.
Before we jump into the second half of the presentation, there were a number of follow-up questions that were asked last time on Tuesday, and you have a document that I provided in printed copy. It will also be on OLS. I apologize. I realized as I got over here the slides that are in this document are not necessarily legible. I will email you the slides at my earliest opportunity. But just to quickly go over the questions that were asked and a couple of the answers, Representative Smith-Warner asked us to provide some information about the grant disbursement detail relative to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, specifically some of the numbers that underlie the information that we showed graphically. We have provided that as an attachment. I would note that there was an eligibility change in the way we considered eligible students in 2016-2017 for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which shows that in the graph, it shows up as a decline in number of eligible students. It's related to how we calculated eligibility more than it's related to the number of applications that we have received. So even though the chart is continuous, you have to consider that there was a policy break in there that does affect the number. Representative Smith-Warner also asked about the rate of FAFSA viability. Unfortunately, in the 2 days we had, we were not able to determine a reason for the decline in the viability of FAFSAs. I would point out that the most current year data that was available to you on that slide is partial year data, so it is possible that the viability rate will increase as the FAFSA year continues. The third question we had was on the cost of administering state financial aid programs. We do have Andrea Henderson here for the community colleges and Keith Robb here representing OSU and the universities at large that can provide some information on the institutional cost of administering state financial aid for HEC. The costs are actually relatively modest. For the 15-17 biennium, the cost of administering the Opportunity Grant was about $287,000, and the cost to administer the Promise Grant during the first year was about $335,000. The reason the Promise Grant administration is higher is there are more criteria. It's a merit-based program. So it's a slightly separate application process. There's more tracking involved, hence the higher administrative cost. And then finally, Senator Monroe asked about attainment and completion rates in Eastern Oregon. We have provided a slide that really shows that his premise is correct, at least relative to the universities. That the attainment rate at Eastern Oregon University is below the statewide completion rate at large. I'll let Juan talk a little bit about the outreach that we do in Eastern Oregon, but if there's if you wish to have a more detailed academic discussion about the reasons for those attainment rates, I'm happy to set that up. Eastern Oregon did provide a little bit of information that indicates that because of the wide geographical area of rural counties and towns that they draw from, they do tend to get a student that is academically less prepared relative to a student that attends any one of the other six public universities. So I'll turn it over to Juan and let him talk about that outreach, and then we can launch into the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
In your packet, you will see a map of our great state of Oregon indicating OSAC's Aspire site presence. And you'll recall that Aspire is our outreach program that we have. We work with many high schools and community-based organizations you'll see in that map the distribution of the sites that we have in Eastern Oregon. One of the things I would highlight that is different this academic year is that in the summer, we had a retirement in our Aspire staff, and we were able to restructure a bit how we allocate staffing resources. So we now have a half-time employee located in Bend, servicing the central and northeastern part of the state, and we also have a half-time employee working out of Southern Oregon, serving the southern part and southeastern part of the state. So our intention is to expand the sites that we have. There are currently about over 10 different sites that are considering joining Aspire, so we're looking at an expansion. Hopefully this time next year, we're talking about how we're planning to expand that program, which creates great results. And the slide behind that will highlight for you the current impact of the Aspire efforts in Eastern Oregon. As you can see, we have a total of 29 different sites, seven of which are middle schools, which is very important where we start developing that pipeline, start building the thought process about planning for school, getting academically prepared for school, and you can see the number of students enrolled, and most importantly, the number of volunteer hours, because the impact of Aspire is exponential because of the volunteers. And those volunteer hours make it work, make it very successful for the students. You can see a fiscal estimate of the impact of those volunteer hours. The success associated with the students that are participating in Aspire in Eastern Oregon, as you can see, a great percentage of them have taken the SATs. They have applied for financial aid, 92%, and that's very, very important. We talked about that on Tuesday. And a good percentage of them have applied for the OSAC scholarships, the scholarships that we administer at OSAC, well over 62%. And one of the final slides that you have will give you an indication of the OSAC scholarship recipients from Eastern Oregon. This is also something that we're looking at very closely. Another slide that you have in your packet relates to the FAFSA Plus sites, and we've talked about our FAFSA Plus initiative. It's an initiative to increase the number of FAFSAs being filed, particularly for students in the K-12 system coming out of the pipeline, and you'll see a breakdown by county. In that table, we sought to include for you the number of FAFSA Plus sites overall, and then those that are Aspire and FAFSA Plus, because we have some sites that have both initiatives going, and then you have some that are just purely FAFSA Plus. And we have a greater number of FAFSA Plus sites, and we're working on some of those FAFSA Plus sites to also make them Aspire sites. So think of it as building that market share build up the good news and the practices of building students' access to college, giving them the background, the resources, and building the community of volunteers that are necessary to make that successful. The very last slide, as I indicated, has a breakdown by sub-region within Eastern Oregon in terms of the OSAC scholarship recipients. And these are primarily the private scholarships that we administer. And in total, as you can see, there are about 782 students awarded that are in post-secondary education right now. And together they received a total of $2,454,000. Of OSAC scholarships. So that gives you a sense of the OSAC outreach efforts to impact that region and promote college attainment.
You're starting your outreach at middle school level?
Yes, Senator Monroe, we do have some sites in Eastern Oregon that are middle school. We have Aspire middle school programs. And Aspire middle school started a few years back. And increasingly, we're seeing more middle schools being interested. We hope to see that grow, because it is the pipeline, if you will, between a middle school into a high school. So if we can plant that seed of post-secondary attainment, and giving them that vision that it is possible, that it's feasible, that our resources, that they can plan for it. And we have very specific curricular guidelines that the coordinators follow, and that the volunteers can support students, and the volunteers get training for this through our Aspire staff, which are now located in that region, to develop that skill set and then augment the growth of students.
I just think that's really important. Historically, you know, we've started talking to kids about going to college when they're juniors or seniors in high school. I think it's really important that you're starting when they're down in middle school years, and planting the seed that you're going to go to college, and here's what you need to do to get ready to go to college and to make your choices and so on. I have a grandson. He's 8th grade, 13. And since he was born, my wife and I have been putting money into his college fund every year. And my wife keeps, we get the sheet that shows how much he's got, and she shows it to him. She says, "See, you got $40,000 or whatever in your college fund." And she just, ever since he was kindergarten age, she's been reinforcing, "You're going to college, and here's the money that's going to pay for your college." And I just, you know, I think you can't start too early, hardly. But, you know, middle school makes me feel a lot better about how we're recruiting these young people and letting them know that, you know, college is available to them. It's an opportunity. And just because maybe your parents didn't go to college or your older brother didn't go to college, you can go.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Now on to Oregon Promise.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Wisnett.
Real quick. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Thomas, thank you for the data you provided about the financial aid. I think we'd all agree transparency is good, and this is something I would hope that the HEC would be sure that students realize it, or the public knows that you're such low administrative costs. You should be proud of that. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Representative. I just want to make sure that the committee is aware that there were a couple of people here from the institutions that are prepared to make a comment about their institutional costs, if you are prepared to receive that. If not, that's fine as well.
Do you want to do that now?
Oh. Do we need to?
Sure.
Can they be brief?
Since they came all this way. Yeah.
Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner and Co-Chair Monroe, and committee members. Thank you for allowing me some time today to come and comment on this issue, and thank you for your commitment to the students of Oregon. My name is Keith Robb. I'm the financial aid director at Oregon State University. Last year, the Oregon Opportunity Grant helped over 4,300 students at OSU with a total of almost $8.5 million. These grant funds help some of our neediest students make the decision to attend college and to persist to graduation. Like all forms of financial aid, the Oregon Opportunity Grant has administrative costs for institutions to manage. And unlike some federal forms of financial aid, the Oregon Opportunity Grant does not include any administrative cost allowance to help institutions run the program. There are many people in a number of offices who take part in managing the Oregon Opportunity Grant at OSU. This includes staff in the financial aid office, business affairs, and IT. The outreach and promotion of these state-based funds are folded into the outreach that we do for financial aid in general. Although we do not staff our offices according to the source of financial aid, I've estimated the administrative cost for the Oregon Opportunity Grant at OSU to be about one full-time equivalent at an approximate cost of $75,000, including benefits.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
And I apologize. Thank you very much for being here. Is there a way you could calculate that as a percentage of, like, of your overall financial aid office operations?
Yes. So
not on the fly necessarily.
Right. You know, we can give you a percentage of what our overall budget, operating budget is, and what percentage one FTE would be.
Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning. Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, for the record. Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. So I have a very rough number for you. I talked to one of the colleges who estimated for the Oregon Promise, it takes about a one-third of an FTE to do the disbursements and administrative part of the Oregon Promise. I'm calculating that out to, they're approximately 10% of the FTE in the state, so calculating that out, it's approximately $300,000 total for the colleges to administer the Oregon Promise. I was not able to get the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but that gives you a sense of the Oregon Promise. Again, that's a very rough figure because it's calculating out what it would be for all the state without getting those actual numbers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good for me. Anybody?
Okay.
Thank you both.
Now on to the Oregon Promise.
Should be, Mr. Chair, these should be on the on OLIS under today also.
Okay.
And I think we're starting on page 15, I believe.
15, yes.
Okay.
Right. You will recall that Oregon Promise is it's a grant program designed to provide a waiver of tuition for community college courses. It is a last dollar program, and the maximum award amount for this academic year is $3,540. It's slightly higher than last academic year because of the tuition increase, so we have to assume that every single year. The goal of this program is to increase college enrollment, completion, affordability for recent high school graduates and GED recipients. I believe the data and information we presented to you before is that indeed it is doing that, and we'll see an update today. Who is eligible for this program? As students have to be recent Oregon high school graduates or GED recipients, have a cumulative GPA of 2.5 or higher, must not have more than 90 college credits completed or attempted, and be an Oregon resident at least the 12 months prior to attendance or prior to completing high school or GED, and are planning to attend, and that's important that the student has to plan to attend a community college within 6 months of graduation. Starting this academic year, 2017-18, the eligibility may be determined by expected family contribution, or EFC. The current EFC limit is $20,000. Additional changes for this year, we've established a waiver process for students under rare circumstances, students with serious illness, injury, or illness or injury or death of a family member, students who go into active military duty or training, including the National Guard, or some unforeseen natural disaster in a region or subregion of our state, that, and also for any certain service, including Future Farmers of America service that a student may be doing. It's a very simple process, a form that the students complete at the community college. We receive that form and then secure and authorize the waiver for that student. And it's a waiver for not starting in immediately within that 6 month window. This numbers that you see here are to date, and I would highlight they're preliminary, and they are likely to change. We expect that there will be an increase in the total number of students who are participating, and also an increase in the dollars disbursed. So what you see is that we have 3,746 students return from last year from cohort number one, about 5,500 from cohort number two, and that number, as I indicated, is likely to increase. And total right now, it's about 9,340 students participating in the program. We started in this academic year with an EFC target of 18,000. You will recall that last summer we were looking at different models, and that was the target. We started with that target, and late in the fall term, when we started receiving early disbursement indicators, early enrollment indicators, we realized that we could increase that EFC target, and indeed we took action to do that and increased it to 20,000 EFC. So the results of that increase are not fully represented here yet, because we need to reconcile those accounts and account for every single student, and also determine if they were attending full-time or part-time, which makes an adjustment on the award. So there's some work for us to do in order to tabulate and update this number. So consider these preliminary. The impact of the EFC criteria, expected family contribution criteria, at 20,000, about four out of five eligible students, the new applicants for fall 2017 are eligible to participate.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I apologize, Director, I'm probably too early and I haven't had enough coffee yet. So the 3,746, and we have 5,000. What's the number we lost of the first year? Because I think that's something we want to be looking at. You know, what our retention rate in this, I hope, is going to be really high, that they're coming back. Now, I understand they may delay and say, I'm going to have to take another year to get more money to come back. But, you know, we're spending, you know, the money to mentor them and make them, you know, all these classes. So our retention rate should be very high.
Representative Wisnett, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, indeed, we're going to go into those details in the next follow-up slides.
Actually, I looked through them before. I should have known that.
With the Oregon Promise, as I indicated, it's the last dollar program. As you can see, the categories of different categories of students. You have a student with a low expected family contribution, a full Pell eligible student, that also is eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So for this academic year would be a student with an EFC of about 3,500 or less. So that student's Oregon Promise award would be the minimum, which is $1,000. For a student who, student B, who has a moderate expected family contribution, they would receive a smaller Pell. They would receive the Oregon Promise Grant to make up the difference. And for student C, who has a higher expected family contribution, they would their expense would be covered by the Oregon Promise solely, because it is a last dollar program. So retention. So the question about retention.
Excuse me. Yes. Representative Parrish.
Can you go back to that slide?
Yes.
So, and so the dashed line is like your, that's going running down, is kind of that $20,000. Is that supposed to represent the $20,000 expected family contribution?
So the dashed line represents, Representative Parrish, the dashed line represents the current average cost for three terms. So you can see it goes down to 3,540. And indeed, when student C, who is at the 20,000 EFC, that's the limit of what we're awarding currently.
So the student at 20,000 and $1 gets nothing, to be clear, because we changed that. But the question I have is, the way when you file for your Pell Grant, and correct me if I'm wrong, under the Oregon Promise, the student has to enroll within a certain time frame post high school. What is that time frame?
6 months from graduation.
So when people fill out their FAFSA for the following fall, it's based on the prior year's taxes. So what happens to the kiddo whose family has a higher expected family contribution because of tax year prior to entrance into fall term? And then when they fill out their FAFSA right after the student enters, where they're still in that six-month window, or maybe they're just slightly past that because of filing taxes, now they have a new FAFSA for the next school year, and that expected lower contribution is dropped, and now they would be qualified, but for the fact that the way kids are applying for financial aid, going into those subsequent terms, they're still even potentially a year within graduating high school, but now that contribution's gone, those kids, I kind of iced them out. Does that make sense? Am I making sense? You file for your FAFSA. Okay, so if my child was going to school fall term of this year, my tax return from 2017 would give me my expected contribution for fall of 18.
Correct.
So he's now 3 months post high school, applying for his fall term. We file April taxes this year. That contribution's gone lower, but by the time we have filed, he's past the six-month window. The new FAFSA shows that a child would otherwise be eligible. So in his second or third term, he would have otherwise been eligible, but for the fact that there's a 6 months post high school because of the way kids are applying for financial aid. So are we losing kids who...
Potentially. Yeah. For Oregon Promise, not necessarily.
For the Oregon Promise.
For the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Specifically.
For other programs, yes. And I think that the gentleman from OSU thought he might have some insight to bring to this.
I like a whiteboard, because that would make more sense.
Sorry. I just wanted to mention that on the FAFSA, it's not the prior year's taxes. It has moved to...
Give me your name once again.
Sorry. I'm Keith Robb, the Director of Financial Aid at Oregon State. The FAFSA has changed.
Okay.
So they now use taxes from the prior year. So for the 18 FAFSA, you're using the 16 taxes.
So that could be theoretically even a worse problem if the 16 taxes showed higher contribution and now maybe somebody lost a job or what have you. Now we're really talking about kids who do not qualify for the Oregon Promise. Income might still not put them in the opportunity grant if you were actually looking at a two-year tax reach. I mean, like, if the
Correct.
Oregon
it can
Promise...
Go, been, it can go both ways.
If the Oregon Promise had been alive and well during the Great Recession, people would have shown in 2008-09 good income, have no job, and these kids would not get that. So I think
But I would argue that would happen no matter. I mean, you can never give a perfect representation. That's for all financial aid. You're always going to have... There's no way to perfectly make sure that you're accurately... You know, reflecting every, there's always going to be, and there will be kids who had a year where maybe their parent didn't work that year so that they could game the FAFSA system. I'm just making this up, but they could do that knowing where it was going to be and then got their, you know, pushed back their big, you know, bonus until the next year so it wouldn't show up so that their kid would, you know, I would argue there's a lot of ways
to
game
it,
and there's no perfect way to assess
given
it.
Given that this is a state problem, or a state program and not a federal program, we might want to consider coming back around in a subsequent session and looking at kids having another kind of mechanism to look at family income as kids are coming out of high school so that they don't miss the opportunity to qualify since they only have 6 months to apply. They would otherwise already meet all that criteria, and some sort of life circumstance change is going to it's going to preclude them from not having access to this program.
And if I may, Mr. Co-Chair, I think there are elements of that. I mean, one of the things that I have talked about in this program is the idea of we talk about wanting to access opportunity youth, kids who dropped out of high school, you know, expanding that range, and that would be a way I feel like you could look at that as well, is to expand who is going to be eligible for that. So yes, there's plenty of things we can do.
And since
to keep
this
improving
is
this
a
program.
New program, believe me, as long as I'm in the legislature anyway, we're going to continue to track it. We're going to continue to, if necessary, modify it as we learn more about how it works and any flaws that there might be. It's a new program, and you know, this committee or other appropriate committees, like policy committees, will be tracking this as we go. I would expect we'll be spending quite a bit of time reviewing it in the 2019 session and beyond. Nothing's perfect. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Juan, go ahead.
Some retention for cohort number one, the first year of experience for this program.
Most of the students completed all the requirements, so that's worth celebrating. About 70% of the full recipients enrolled for all three terms. They enrolled at least 6 credits each term, and they completed the first-year experience. As you recall, this program requires a first-year experience. For those that 87% of those fall students who were enrolled in the winter, and you saw that, we reported on that last year, and 74% of those fall students enrolled in the 3 consecutive terms. So consecutive enrollment is something that's important and required in this program. First year experience, the first year course experience, if you call it that, 94% of those who were enrolled in all 3 terms completed that first year experience. Mm-hmm. And the course load of these students, about 71% of them were enrolled full time in all 3 terms. So you had a good propensity of full time enrollment for these students. I think that's the positive side of the impact of the program.
That fall to winter number of 87%, how would that compare to students that are not in this program?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I think we would have to do a little bit of research for you, and it'll take some time.
I know it's quite a bit lower than 87%.
Yeah.
That students just the way it used to be without these programs that come in the fall, there's quite a big drop-off between fall and winter quarters. At least that was my experience when I was on college boards.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know what those numbers are.
Thank you, and we'll certainly look at doing some of that research. And it'd be important to look at a comparative age group that are just starting college. Yeah. So it's closer to an apples-to-apples comparison.
Senator Monroe,
yes.
We'll get you the exact number, and thank you for the question. It's a really important one when you're determining whether or not the program is as effective as we all hope it would be. I would just point out that the course load figure is also similarly dramatic. The numbers of students that are part-time students in the community college versus full-time that aren't on the promise, the numbers are essentially reversed from what you see here in terms of proportion that are full-time to part-time. So it has, at least in the number of credits students are taking, it's had quite a bit of an impact.
Yeah, well, it's important when I'm talking to people, and I talk to people quite a bit, and I talk about the Oregon Promise, that I be able to cite exactly, you know, what the benefit is. And this is, you know, it's pretty dramatic, I know, but having those numbers in my head is very important.
Thank you. We certainly get back to you with some research data. Of those students, nearly all students with the remaining eligibility return for year 2. And this is the question, who's returning? How many of them are returning? We did note that a few of them enrolled at public universities. And we will continue to monitor this transitions. How are these students transitioning to other institutions? And at what point are they transitioning? So for the fall of 2017, we had, as I indicated, 3,746 of the students that started in the fall of 2016 returning. So about 84% of Cohort 1 students who completed all the requirements that I listed earlier, and who were not at the 90-credit limit, returned in year 2. And recall that last spring we talked about some students getting closer to that 90-credit limit pretty quickly because they had bought in credits that they earned previously. Some students did not fulfill all the requirements, usually missing a term, and about 30% of the students did not complete all the requirements that were required for the program. Nearly all missed one or more terms of enrollment, so they were not continuously enrolled. And about 94% of those students who missed a term had not met the 90-credit limit. So they had not reached that benchmark. And you can see here some of the reasons for denial. Primarily, it's not being consecutively enrolled in school. Or we did have 157 that attempted or or completed 90 or more college credits, so that's worth celebrating. And you'll see that there are a few who had a FAFSA or a full FORSA that was filed very late or rejected, FAFSA, and they weren't able to clarify those particular reasons. Now, reasons for renewal eligibility in terms of year to year, what do the students need to do to stay eligible? And we're making efforts to remind them directly from OSAC, and I know the colleges do so as well. And the student must complete that first year experience as directed by the community college. They must maintain satisfactory academic progress while they're in school. And they must be continuously enrolled at least half time during fall, winter, and spring of each term, and they must complete any other requirement that is set forth by the community college, and not exceed the maximum of 90 credits. So, very simple outline. Obviously, it's for students, and as Senator Monroe indicated, you know, the retention rate, completion rate is very high for this group, and I think we can continue to make efforts to reinforce the key messages of what they need to do to stay eligible for the program and stay and participate in the program, and continue to monitor the success of these students and the patterns and transition patterns, as well as their needs. As I indicated, we did establish an advisory group for us at OSAC, a Oregon Promise advisory group of community college representatives, primarily individuals who administer financial aid and also student services. So we get an understanding of what are the pressure points, what are the issues, what are the challenges for the students, as well as the administrative part, any administrative coordinations or improvements that we can do between our office and the community college offices in order to facilitate the success of the students. One last point, this program is a last dollar program, and that nature of the program maximizes federal aid. As you can see, at the bottom, Oregon Promise students received an estimated $5.2 million in Pell Grants in the fall of 2016, and that amount has increased to about $8.1 million Pell dollars in this fall term of 2017. Any questions?
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thanks for all the presentation and everything. I think everyone up here and everyone in the legislature is hoping this is going to be a successful program. We've put some money in it. Two quick questions. How many other states have started a promise program like ours? And we started this when I was the vice chair of the higher ed, and we modeled after Tennessee. How's the Tennessee program? I understood they had a delay that didn't really get started until we did. If you have any comments on those, and that's what the advisory committee, I hope, will be looking at, you know, other states and learn, not look, look outside of Oregon to see lessons learned and improvements and things.
Representative Wisnett, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, I will have to get back to you with some exact updates, number updates of the number of states that have started these programs. We've had some states contact us, but also community college districts on their own starting these programs. They're not all necessarily like ours. They have, some have slight differences. And the Tennessee model, it is still very active, but as you know, they started with a very large endowment that allowed all applicants and all comers who were in that target category. And I'll be delighted to follow up with a report to you.
Thank you.
On the current efforts.
Good. Additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doug, where are we? Well, Mr. Chair, we have a work session on House Bill 4065.
Should we send these until Julie comes back?
Yeah, I guess so, but let me go see if I can track down.
Okay, okay, we'll
But if she has an amendment, yes, it will be passed. We have to post it for an hour.
We'll be at ease.
Is the Senate on the
4065A?
Mr. Wilson. Mr. Chair, House Bill 4065 passed out of Representative Lively's committee. I'm not sure if it's unanimously or not.
It was.
Okay. And it provides additional enforcement capacity to the Office of Child Care of the Early Learning Division. It increases civil penalties for violations by child care facilities. The fiscal shows the extent of those increases in fines and penalties that are projected. I will say that the projections are, they're hard to project, let's put it that way. So, but they do not make a very large share. Yeah. And there are a number of other factors that are taken care of, mainly to increase the quality of care in child care and allow the child care division to explore, you know, and investigate and enforce child care regulations. There is one amendment that comes to you from the Ways and Means co-chairs. It currently, the penalties that are under this section that's being amended are deposited in the child care fund. There's less than $10,000 of in the 17-19 under existing law. Instead of having that dedicated to the child care fund, we are following the direction that is in the case of most fines and violations and penalties that are deposited in the general fund. This should not cause any hardship to the agency for sure, this by any means, because they're only collecting about $9,000 under current law. And then as we build the budget, if we need backfill for any of that, we will take care of that in the budget. So that is the dash A2 amendments. I would need a motion, or you would need a motion, I'm sorry. Better shut up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the A2 amendment to House Bill, or is it a House Bill?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
House Bill 4065.
Discussion, Representative Wisner.
Mr. Wilson, I didn't understand the fund. What's the fund, purpose of the fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, the Child Care Fund is their operating fund in the sense that's where all the federal revenues go. Any fees for various reasons, for background checks, it's basically their operating fund.
Okay, and can Mr. Co-Chair follow up, please? Thank you. Mr. Wilson, what's the penalties? I haven't, you know, we just got this, I guess.
Mr. Chair, there is a, on the posted, there is a fiscal impact statement that has fines, the fines listed. And I think it was loaded this morning. If not, I can hand, I have a hard copy here. Those are the changes.
No, we're good. I got to leave at 9:30.
And this is the result of a work group that I believe Representative Lively was headed up along with others on increasing.
Could,
yes, that is right.
Could I ask Mr. Co-Chair,
Representative Lively,
those are pretty significant. Did you, there was a lot of discussion.
Yes.
Why?
And there was a lot. Thank you, Representative Wisnett and co-chairs. So we had quite a bit of discussion when we got to the point of the level that these charges should be. And the debate was about, so what level do they need to be to where they become a deterrent? Because at the level they're at currently, it's not a deterrent. People will just violate and then pay the $100 or $200. And the stakeholders, which is a pretty broad group of people sitting at the table, providers and others, agreed this level would be one that would make people think before they would just violate. Versus doing it. So the goal here isn't try to raise a bunch of money. The goal is to try to reach compliance and make the proposed fees high enough that those that might be subject to them would think about complying with not just violating.
Okay. Motion is to adopt the A2 amendment. Further discussion? Any objection to adopting the A2 amendment?
Nay.
Representative Wisnant votes no.
So if I'm so the yeah. A2 amendment is simply changing it from the child care fund or the operating fund to general fund.
Right.
Is all
it,
this
it only
does.
Deals it with where it's deposited.
Right. This is part of the bill and that, the fees. This is just changing where it would go.
Change my vote, Mr. Co-Chair, to the A2 amendment.
Motion on the A2 amendment is adopted. Now, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe, I move House Bill 4065 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Discussion of the motion. Representative Wisnant.
I'm a big supporter of daycare for 20 years. I've said, and I said on 3 education, I forget which one I've said this, but we need daycare. I've talked to the early learning division people about their mission and the request for additional funding and FTEs. And I keep repeating, I hope I'm not doing that in this committee more, but we have to be careful that we create this system of going out and looking at the daycares and closing them down by aggressive inspectors on issues that are not, safety of the child is primary, and if anything is affecting it. But I have constituents who have had their facility closed down because a vent wasn't up to standard codes and things, and that affects families and children. And so I may change my mind on the floor, but probably be a no out of committee. And it's not because I don't support more inspection and safety and more daycares, but I want to I have to read the bill and study it more before I vote on the floor. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Additional discussion, Representative Lively.
So first, I just want to say thank you to the co-chairs and to move this legislation. This is important to get done right away because there's real problems within this, and this gives us the tools that we need to start responding quicker. And I believe, in response to what Representative Wisnant says, it gives us more tools to make sure that we get it right earlier so that we don't end up closing a facility that we don't have the thing, so we end up with investigations. And so when we talked about that, that's the whole goal is child safety, but part of the goal is to make sure we get in there quick enough and figure out what's going on so we get it right, because our goal, again, isn't just to close places down, but to get them in compliance so they can keep operating. But I appreciate your concerns.
Okay. Additional discussion? Okay, the motion is to move 4065 as amended to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Objections?
Nay, but I may change my mind.
Okay.
Before,
Representative Wisnant is a no. Any others? Motion's adopted. Carriers?
Madam Co-Chair. I missed all my carries last week.
Madam Co-Chair will carry to full Ways and Means and to the floor of, well, or do you want Representative Lively
probably
to carry
Lively.
It?
You want to carry it on the
Representative
floor?
Lively yeah. to the House floor, and I will carry to the Senate floor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Doug, where are we?
We're done.
No, it's that short.
Yeah, no, that's
we do not have any more meetings scheduled, but there will likely be policy bills that may come our way.
So stay tuned. Whether we meet next Tuesday or not, we don't know. Because if we get additional policy meetings, then we will. So.
And do we have any informational hearings on
nothing
for next week?
Nothing scheduled, no.
Oh.
Okay. Anything else, Madam Co-Chair? We're adjourned. Thanks, Jeff.